So we had been analyzing this action, the action of single field Sobol inflation in ADM variables and the Maldacena gauge. And what we had actually been analyzing is the gravity wave sector, where zeta is zero and we're expanding to second order in gamma. I'm going to start speeding up a little. I've actually kind of enjoyed the pace of the last couple days working through a lot of the tricks. I mean, the picture here is sort of clear at a high level, but the tricks are, well, tricky. So I think it's useful to show at least some of them. So today I'm going to try to get through, the rest of the main calculation, this gravity wave sector to second order in gamma, and then the scalar sector to third order in zeta. But I'm going to gloss over a lot of algebra and just show you when new tricks arise that are sort of conceptually interesting. Maybe I'll show them to you. I want to show you a few of the new tricks, because you know, who knows, they may even be useful in a homework problem or a tutorial or something. So last time we'd analyzed this term S1 in the action and shown that it was equal to 1/8. In real space, could be written like this. Or in Fourier space, like this. So let's just discuss briefly the term S2. So I calculated S2. Eij is just the time derivative of the metric. In general, there's a psi term, but that's zero in this gravity wave sector. And then if you work that out, so Hij is a squared times delta ij plus gamma ij. Here's Hij to second order. You get a term where you differentiate the H, which brings down, you differentiate the A, which brings out AH. So that just gives A times H times the original metric, plus terms where I differentiate the gammas. When you go on to contract Eij with itself, or to contract with the metric tensor to compute E, then something which is really useful. So first consider, let's call this quantity in parentheses E1. So I just noticed, this was a little messy, but I noticed this little fact that makes life easy, that if you take this piece and contract it with the metric includes higher order terms in gamma, of course, that that contraction is zero to second order in gamma. this was just sort of a nice way of organizing cancellations that happened when I computed this action. You can show that explicitly. So h, to verify that, you need to know h upper ij to second order. You know, you're just inverting, so the a squared in front becomes a to the minus 2. And then you get this minus sign, the identity matrix plus a first order correction inverts a first order to same matrix with the minus sign. I'm using notation where I always put lower indices on gamma, so let's write that like this. Anyway, when you multiply this out to second order, you get terms where this gamma combines with this gamma dot, and then you get terms where the delta combines with, was just multiplying these gamma-gamma dots. When you put everything together, you get zero, right? Yeah, okay. The first order term, there's one term that, the first order term is hij gamma ij dot, sorry, delta ij gamma ij dot. But that's zero because it's just the derivative of the gauge condition, delta ij gamma ij equals zero. Okay. So then, armed with this identity, it's straightforward to compute stuff like E is hij eij. And this is just canceling out and you just get 3h. Eij, Eij. The cross term where you contract h with E1 is 0. And so this is just h, 3h squared from self-contracting this. When you self-contract this to second order in gamma, you get a squared. So you get 1/4 delta ik delta jl gamma ij dot. Gamma kale dot. There's an a to the fourth that cancels the factor of a to the fourth in the metric. And so plugging all this in, you get S2 equals 1/8 integral dt to 3x a cubed. Let's write it as square root h. Delta ik delta jl gamma ij dot. Looking back at the action in this gravity wave sector, the S3 and S4 terms are zero because they just involve since zeta is zero, these are just some functions of time, which are with no powers of the fluctuations in them. Those are unimportant. Those are just part of the zeroth order part of the action that doesn't contribute to equations of motion or anything. So putting everything together, we were just trying to compute to quadratic order in the gravity wave sector. That's all that's really observationally relevant right now, although if gravity waves are ever detected, you might start thinking about non-Gaussianity in the gravity wave sector. That would be a fun world to live in. Anyway, putting all of this together, the action is delta ij. So now we're going to run, we found the quadratic action. Now we're just going to run our little machine that tells us for a set of time-dependent harmonic oscillators how the operators evolve. So the first step is to switch to Fourier space, which diagonalizes things by making each Fourier mode independent. And I'm going to further diagonalize by defining basis transverse traceless tensors for each k. So for each Fourier mode k, there are two independent transverse traceless tensors. So I can write gamma ijk equals the sum from s equals 1 to 2 of gamma s k times epsilon ijs. I guess there should really be a t here and a t here. Where I just choose for each k, I've just defined these basis tensors. So a non-covariant way to say it is that if the Fourier mode points in the z direction, that the basis tensors that I want are just this guy and this guy. These are the independent tensors that have trace zero and also dot product zero with the k mode, which is the other gauge condition, the transverse condition. A more covariant way to say it is that these should satisfy delta ij epsilon ij equals 0. Ki epsilon ij equals 0. And the normalization is such that if I have two of these guys, there's only one way to contract them. If I do this contraction, I get 2 delta SS prime. That's the normalization that's consistent with this non-covariant picture. If I switch to Fourier space, the different k's diagonalize, and these different s's also diagonalize. When I put in gamma ij as some set of time-dependent coefficients times epsilon ij, and then contract here, this contraction is diagonal in s. So each Fourier mode and each polarization state just evolve independently. Let's write out the action. So the coefficient is now 1/4 because of this factor of 2. Cubed. I'll write the h squared as the square root of h as an explicit factor of a cubed. Times the sum over s of gamma s dot gamma s minus, let me put the a cubed here. Minus a k squared s. So the term with the time derivatives has an a cubed, and the term with no time derivatives has an a. So each each gamma sk evolves independently. It's an independent time-dependent harmonic oscillator. And the action for this single degree of freedom is this 1/4 integral of dt cubed gamma k dot, where I've compactified notation a little. Gamma k star, gamma k with no time derivative. Okay. So let's switch to conformal time. That tends to make life easier when writing down field equations of motion or, evolution equations for a single k-mode. But without switching to conformal time, we'll equalize these two coefficients. So in conformal time, where dt is a d tau, the action just has a factor of a squared and then gamma k prime star gamma k prime minus k squared gamma k star gamma k star. My notation is that over dots denote derivatives with respect to proper time, and primes denote derivatives with respect to conformal time. So this is the same action. This action is easy to understand intuitively. It's the same action that we saw before for a massless field in De Sitter, but with the factor of 1 over ht squared that appeared in the pure De Sitter case, replaced by a squared here. So this slightly generalizes to, an inflationary background which is close to De Sitter. This is what you would get if you just put a massless scalar field on a inflationary near De Sitter background. You get the same action for each k-mode of that scalar field. Okay. So our procedure that we developed in the first week. For understanding the evolution of this mode in quantum mechanics, how it gets excited out of the ground state is to so I find it useful to canonically normalize by defining sigma equals a gamma over root 2. So this is the field redefinition that makes the coefficient of sigma dot squared the standard 1/2. So with that time-dependent normalization, the action is, and there's a step here, there's an integration by parts to get rid of, there's a sigma dot term. You just replace sigma dot by 1/2 times the derivative of sigma squared and then integrate by parts to shift the convert that to a sigma squared term. There was a similar term when we talked about the massless field in De Sitter. So after doing that step, which I'll sort of gloss over because we did something similar before, you get this action where omega t, omega of k tau is equal to, one way to write it is this is what I got when I did the integration by parts. And then another way to write it, which you'll often see in the literature, is this combination of A's and H's happens to be equal to minus 1 over A, minus A double prime over A. So this is this is with this form for omega, sorry, this is omega squared. With this form for omega squared, the equation of motion for sigma is called the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation. So this is the Mukhanov-Sasaki form for the frequency. Oh, that's absolutely right, yeah. By the way, this doesn't make any slow roll approximation. This is exact all orders and slow roll. Okay, so I'm going to write, so now we can read off, well, I was going to say we can write down the solution to the free QFT, but of course what I really mean is that we can express the solution of the QFT in terms of some classical differential equations. So for the canonically normalized field, the QFT has this solution. The reason I like the canonically normalized field is that the initial conditions for the mode function are transparent. This mode function V is just satisfies the same equation that the K mode of a classical field with this action would satisfy. This equation with this form of omega squared is what's called the Mukunov-Sasaki equation. With initial condition that says that at early times this goes to a purely negative frequency oscillator with normalization 1 over 2k to the 1 halves. That's what we found you needed to match the initial conditions of being in the vacuum state at early times. Another way to express the solution for the free QFT is to write down the time dependence of the gamma operators. So these are, the gamma operators you're just putting in have some solution like this. And of course, the mode function UK that appears here, since gamma is root 2 over A times sigma, is the mode function here is just root 2 over A times the mode function for the sigma field. But I'll also find it useful, you'll see why in a minute, to write down the equation of motion for U. So either by making this change of variables in the equation of motion for V, or just by computing the equation of motion of gamma in the classical action above, you can find this equation of motion for U. So, it's basically equivalent to solve the differential equation for V or U. For a complicated potential, what you would have to do is integrate. People sometimes talk about. We're thinking about slow roll inflation here, which is actually the case where cubic and higher interactions are small and a perturbative QFT approach is justified. People like to think about. There's a surprisingly large number of papers in the literature that think about like potentials with weird bumps and wiggles and things. The motivation for this is trying to fit weird bumps and wiggles in the CMB. Like if you look at the CMB power spectrum, there's like a dip at around L equals 20 that's been around for a long time, followed by another little bump at a slightly higher L. These are of sort of borderline statistical significance, like probability a few percent that you would get them by chance. Which personally, my personal take is that that's not high enough to really reach any conclusion. What's nice is that measurements of E-mode polarization, when they happen in the same L range, will shed a lot of light. You'll see if you see these same features, and that will tell you whether they're actually in the early universe or not, or they're just statistical flukes. A lot of people like this. In the meantime, people have played fun games. Like, let's say you put a little bump in the effective potential for the inflaton. Like, maybe there's a little phase transition happening in some subdominant sector during inflation. How do, this actually, you can actually make a little bump if you choose the bump right, match the wiggles seen in the CMB temperature power spectrum at low L. Although it's unclear if this, since this is an a posteriori thing that was motivated by something with borderline statistical significance, it's hard to draw any conclusion. For a complicated potential, what you'd have to do is first find the solution to the background equations of motion by integrating those equations. And then you feed, once you find A as a function of tau, say, you just feed it in numerically to the Mukunov-Sasaki equation and solve for the mode functions. But in the slow roll limit, I claim that, so to leading order and slow roll parameters, I claim that the mode function u goes to h star over k cubed at late times. Where the star means, h is a slightly time-dependent quantity in single-field slow roll inflation, and the star means that you evaluate at the time of horizon crossing. The time when this exponentially increasing time-like parameter becomes equal to the wave number of interest. AH is the inverse co-moving Hubble length. So this is just the time when the Hubble length during inflation, which if I invert everything is a decreasing quantity, becomes equal to the wavelength of my mode. It's hard to give, I found it hard to give a fully airtight, convincing argument for this. In many, oh, you know, I forgot a square here. A hand-waving argument that's sometimes made is that for a massless scalar field in De Sitter, so all the interesting physics happens at horizon crossing. Before horizon crossing, the canonically normalized field is just stuck in its vacuum state. After horizon crossing, what happens is that gamma is conserved. So the canonically normalized field would be conserved up to constant up to a factor of a. As far as the interesting physics happening near horizon crossing is concerned, you may as well be a massless field in De Sitter. Since in the slow roll limit, h just varies by a small fractional amount per Hubble time, if I just take a little window of time, a few Hubble times around horizon crossing, this field thinks that it's a massless field in De Sitter, and it acquires fluctuations on the order of squared amplitude, h squared over 2k cubed is what we found before for a massless field in De Sitter. And there's an extra factor of root 2, the way that I've normalized things for gamma, an extra factor of 2 relating gamma to the canonically normalized field, which is why this is h squared over k cubed instead of h squared over 2k cubed. So I want to, I think to fully prove that this argument is correct, you know, at a fully convincing standard of rigor, you would need to develop some sort of perturbation theory that organizes the solutions of this differential equation order by order in slow roll parameters. Then you could really prove at the level of doing a derivation that this statement is true. I'm not quite going to do that. I sort of searched around before the lecture to see if I could find some way of doing some rigorous approach that was wouldn't take half an hour of algebra to present, but I failed to find such an approach. But let me try to just sort of make this intuitive argument a little more mathematical. If we divide, so AH is a quantity which is exponentially increasing roughly to the in the approximation that H is constant, exponentially increasing in proper time, or increases as 1 over tau in conformal time. If I divide the evolution into an early time regime, a horizon crossing regime, and a late time regime, then if you stare at the differential equations, I think you can convince yourself that at early times, the field is just, so the V mode function, the canonically normalized field, is just behaving as a harmonic oscillator. with constant frequency k. The corrections are coming in as the corrections are coming in as a squared h squared or a squared h dot. And those all, because you know, ah is an exponentially decreased, is a decreasing quantity, those are all small at early times. You have to be a little careful with this sort of argument, since you might think that the same argument applies to the U field with the equation of motion, with to the gamma field itself, with the equation of motion in this form. But it's not true that this term is becoming small at early times because AH is becoming small. It's not true that U behaves as a harmonic oscillator at early times. And the reason that's true is just the power of AH that enters. If you think about it in conformal time, here, the correction is coming in for the V field. The correction is coming in as 1 over time squared. And if I integrate a source in a differential equation that goes as 1 over time squared, at early times, you know, that its integrated contribution can be at most 1 over tau, i.e. something that does fall off at early times. Whereas in the equation of motion for the U field, if I source a differential equation by a term that goes as 1 over time, 1 over tau, as tau goes to minus infinity, that integrates up to a log, which does not become small. So anyway, this is a good approximation, but this would not be. Here's what I conclude if I carefully think about powers of A in the differential equation. At late times, the same sort of analysis will show that U is constant. What's happening at late times, not super transparent in V, but in U, at late times, AH is blowing up. It's exponentially increasing. And so what's happening is that I have an exponentially large friction term. Physically, it's clear that such a term will just freeze the field. What happens in between? So in between, I think that I'm a free field in de Sitter. And our earlier analysis showed that if I, for a free field in de Sitter, if I input a field which goes as V naught e to the minus ik tau at early times, where early just means starting a few Hubble times before horizon crossing, then in terms of the canonically normalized field, what I get out at the end will be this. If I just these two terms dominate in the pre-horizon crossing and post-horizon crossing limits. This is what we got for a free field in de Sitter. If I just transplant that to this period of a few Hubble times near horizon crossing, this is what I get. So now I can just match up and see what happens at late times. At late times, I know that U is a constant. Which constant? Well, I just take this expression, keep only the last term, convert to the field U by putting in, there's no 2 k cubed here. Sorry, this is just V0. Which constant does it go to? Well, it goes as, there's some phase that I won't keep track of, times V0, which is 1 over 2 k to the 1/2, times this factor, AH over K, times the conversion from V to U, which is root 2 over A. And all of this is evaluated at horizon crossing. Putting all of this together, I get a phase times h over k to the 3/2, which is what I wanted to show. So now we've calculated the amplitude of gravity waves at the end of inflation. Let's just convert this to observer's notation. The observers define with the normalization for gamma that I for gamma s that I gave before. So observers were set will say, well, we're measuring this function p gamma of k, where the 1/4 here is just a historical convention. And so our calculation gives p gamma is equal to this factor of 4 times h star over m Planck, h star squared over m Planck squared times k to the minus 3. Evaluated at horizon crossing. Evaluated at h equals k. When I observe power in the CMB, you can imagine that I'm looking back, so I observe power at, well, in the CMB, I observe it at some L, but that's really k. That matches primordial power at k equals L over d. And you can imagine that I'm looking back to a time at during inflation where the exponentially growing co-moving couple scale AH was equal to that value. So inflation generates modes in the CMB sequentially with modes at the lowest L, like the physical scale of our current horizon first, and modes at high L, small scale modes last. Each power of E in the wave number corresponds to one Hubble time during inflation. So since we observe, say, order E to the 10 range of multipoles in the CMB, we get to see roughly 10 Hubble times during inflation. By the way, what observers usually quote is this quantity gamma defined by k cubed over 2 pi squared times p gamma. So we're predicting 2 over pi squared h star squared over another observable that gets discussed is the tensor tilt. Which is so that quantity delta squared is nearly constant in k because h is nearly constant in time during inflation, but it has some slow dependence on k, which is related to time dependence of h, i.e., slow roll parameters. In general, this would just be, I guess, minus 2 h dot over h squared. But to leading order in slow roll, well, I leave it to you to show using the slow roll equation of motion. And generally, I've been glossing over sort of slow roll ology calculations like this, where I just use the differential equations of the background solution, that this is minus 2 epsilon, where epsilon, remember, was m Planck squared over 2 v prime over v squared. So epsilon is always positive, and the tensor tilt is always negative. In other words, this function delta squared must be a decreasing function of k, have a little more power on large scales than small scales. That's also true because h dot during inflation had better be negative. Otherwise, you have a situation where something's climbing to higher and higher values of its potential, which doesn't make any physical sense. So this seems to be the expectation that the tensor tilt be nearly zero, but slightly negative is a really robust prediction of inflation because it's just tied direct. You're just tracking the energy scale as inflation progresses. If one day we measure gravity waves and we find that they have a blue tilt, that would be a real puzzle. I really have no idea how we'd reconcile that with our current models of the early universe. Okay, so now, Frankenstein's monster, the scalar sector to cubic order. So let me start with, there are four terms in the action which I labeled above. Let me start with S2. Now, I'm just going to walk through some of the more, there's four terms and all of them are kind of a mess. I'm just going to walk through some of the more interesting features of this calculation. So this object Eij is equal to this. Now we have the psi term, which is, I can write the Hij dot. So in the scalar sector, the metric is just a squared e to the 2 zeta delta ij with no gamma term. So when I differentiate with respect to time, differentiating the a pulls down ah, differentiating with respect to the 2 zeta pulls down 2 zeta dot. So the first term just ends up being h plus zeta dot times the original metric itself. That's actually true to all orders in zeta. Minus, I'll just leave this term as grad I. Okay, so I plug this in. I contracted Eij with itself, contracted with the metric tensor to compute E, divided by this. It was a big mess, but here's what I got. So skipping a lot of steps. So a term with no spatial derivatives, that you can organize like this. Plus this interesting looking term. Okay. Now, let me, I guess I'll put this up. Let me just do a little interlude. I'm going to give you guys a little GR quiz. Let's say that I had this slightly simpler integral. I want to say that this is 0, because I can just integrate by parts to put the delta I here, bring this this grad I over here, integrate by parts again to bring this grad j over here, and then I'll have del squared psi minus del squared psi squared, which all cancels out and gives 0. What do you guys think, true or false? Why is it false? Yeah, that's exactly right. So a general statement one can make is that since this is true in flat space, it'll be true up to curvature terms in curved space. Okay, so let's work out those curvature terms. Let's try to make Disintegration by parts happen one step at a time. First I'll bring the grad I over. Is this correct? Am I allowed to do this? Oh, minus, obviously. I also forgot the square root h. Okay. Yeah, this is okay. I mean, in general, you can always, the rule is that as long as the grad I is the outer derivative, you can bring it over. So now I'm going to start commuting stuff around. I'm going to try to bring this grad J to the outside so I can integrate by parts and put it here. Let's take this one step at a time. So in this step, I've just commuted these indices. Is that okay? This I and this J. Yeah, there's no curvature term because it's acting on a scalar, and it doesn't matter that there's another derivative on the outside. This is just some, you know, self-contained tensor that commutes. Okay, but of course, when I commute these two, I will get the curvature term. So I'll write that next. So let's just switch the lower and index or and upper here or and lower and upper here, which I can do inside a covariant derivative, even with the covariant derivative sandwiched in between, because the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. Okay, so then if I commute the covariant derivatives, I get a curvature term, which is, so I have a curvature. The sign flips when the commutator of grad I and grad J acts on an object with an upper index. There's a, R is defined so that there's a sign flip. So I get this curvature commutator times I sign. Minus the term with the grad J and grad I commuted. Now these two terms cancel because now the grad J is on the outside, so there's no problem integrating my parts to put it here. Sign flips and it cancels this term. And then this contraction of R with itself is the definition of the Ricci tensor. This is actually minus the Ricci tensor. And so this is actually true to all orders. In general, if you had this expression in a situation with a metric, you would get a non-zero answer with the Ricci tensor and two fewer covariant derivatives appearing. Okay, so when I plug this in up here, I'll get these sorts of curvature terms. And then the other term that I didn't keep track of here. By the way, because the curvature is first order in the fluctuations here, the curvature terms come in at third order. And then another thing that I didn't keep track of in this calculation was this prefactor of 1 plus theta dot over h. So that'll give more terms when I do the integrations by parts. I'll have to keep track of terms where the derivative acted on this. So there are two types of terms if you expand out S2. You end up with two types of terms. The important thing really is that this entire second line ends up being third order in the fluctuations. There are curvature terms which are have one more power of the fluctuations. It's naively second order. And then there are terms where derivatives act on zeta dot, which are also third order. I get this first line plus these cubic terms. Oh, one more thing. I need the Ricci tensor for this metric. Any suggestions to go about computing it? Yeah, exactly. You know the Ricci tensor without the e to the 2 zeta, you know the Ricci tensor is zero. I mean, A is time dependent, but we're just talking about spatial curvature. Then when you put in the e to the 2 zeta, there's just the standard set of formulas you look up to tell you what the Ricci tensor is. So I looked those up in Wald, and I'm plugging them in here. So the first line here is curvature terms from commuting derivatives. And the second line is integration by parts terms where a derivative acted on this zeta dot. Here's what I get. Okay. So that's one of the terms in the action. Let's do S1. Okay, I'm again gonna, just like I skipped the routine algebraic details here and just concentrated on the trickier bits, I'm gonna do the same for this one. Okay, so the first step, of course, is working out R3 to third order, which would be a huge pain from scratch, but you can just use these formulas that tell you what happens when the metric conformally changes. If you use the formulas, here's what you get. And then I'll just expand that out. I'll multiply that out. Okay. This first term is just zero because I'm integrating the square root of h times the gradient of something, which is always zero by a formula in general relativity. In fact, that's how the rule for integration by parts, where it comes from. For these remaining terms, I'm going to call this term S1 prime and work on it. Work on it for a bit. So the reason I bring up S1 prime is that if you think about, what you'd want to do to that term in flat space, generally when I have a term in the action with one time derivative, what I want to do is integrate by parts to get rid of the time derivative. That was the trick that I was using for like these U and V fields. So what I'd want to do in flat space with a term like this is first do a spatial integration by parts to make it look like the gradient of zeta dot times the gradient of zeta dot, then write that as 1/2 the time derivative of gradient squared, and then integrate by parts and bring that time derivative around to get rid of the derivative on the zeta. So I found it kind of tricky because these equations are hiding time dependence. There's time dependence hidden in the root h via the e to the zeta, and there's time dependence hidden in the Hubble parameter big H. I found it sort of tricky to do integration by parts in the time direction. So let me just explain how you get the right answer. So see, all of our notation is like covariant in the spatial direction, but there's no like geometric covariance in the time direction. Like the square root h doesn't include any time part of the metric. So the first step is just to the spatial integration by parts is no problem. There's a minus sign. I write it like this. Then in the next step, I'm going to try to bring make this time derivative, bring it to the outside here with a 1/2, and then integrate by parts over. And so I found that to get this right, I had to write out all the time-dependent factors explicitly. So I'm going to temporarily unpack to a non-covariant notation, do the integration by parts, and then covariantize everything. So the square root of h is a cubed times e to the 3 zeta. There's a hidden factor. So if I write this as like this with the metric hij here, so there's a 4 over big H, which is time dependent. And then this hij is hiding a factor of a to the minus 2 e to the minus 2 zeta, delta ij. And then these covariant derivatives with lower indices are just ordinary time derivatives. So I can write that as bringing out the 1/2, 1/2 the time derivative of partial I zeta, partial j zeta. Now in this unpacked form, I can take this time derivative. I guess I should write it as partial derivative with respect to time. Okay. Now in this unpacked form, I can take the time derivative, do the integration by parts, and just differentiate this whole mess that appears in front with respect to time. And when I do that, I get, so skipping a few steps, I get, and I have used the background equations of motion here. In general, I'm A e to the zeta times minus 2 over h zeta dot minus phi dot squared over h squared times delta ij del i zeta del j. Yeah. Okay. Now I sort of recovariantize everything. I convert this a times e to the zeta times delta ij. I convert that back to a square root h times h upper ij times this piece in brackets. times delta I zeta delta J zeta. Which you know, is I've been writing as gradient zeta squared. If I combine that term, this was a piece of S1. If I put it back in S1, you'll see there are a bunch of cancellations. Like this leading term is canceling this term. Did I leave off a piece? Sorry, say that again. Oh, yeah, right. Thanks, that is exactly the cancellation I was looking for. This term is canceling this term. And so S1 just ends up being thanks to these magic cancellations, S1 actually has this purely quadratic form. Is also slow roll suppressed. This factor is suppressed by one. This factor contains one power of epsilon in the slow roll expansion, something which is not obvious here, where S1 appears to be of order epsilon to the zero. Okay, so I'm actually basically, I gloss over a lot of steps, but I'm basically done with the calculation of the action to order zeta cubed. S3 and S4 are very straightforward to write out. In the next lecture, I'll talk about the scalar two-point function and three-point function.